Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Republicans move quickly to put a constitutional amendment on the April ballot, this time addressing Wisconsin's voter ID requirement. Plus, Governor Evers renews his effort to give voters, not lawmakers, the ability to create laws or repeal them. And what the latest fundraising numbers reveal in the high-stakes state Supreme Court race. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for January 10th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., this legislative session began with some contention around a new ballot referendum, which is we're going to get right into right now, which is after the state Senate passed a constitutional amendment, which would ask voters whether to amend the state's somewhat strict, opponents argue, voter ID law into the state constitution. So Senate Republicans approved this measure just days after Inauguration Day on Monday. And this proposal would send it to the Assembly for a vote next week, which we have learned is going to happen on Tuesday. So the whole argument from Democrats throughout this week, throughout committee hearings, is that they argued this process was rushed, they wanted more time, and they preferred many other issues to be before the legislature on week one, such as addressing school safety after the Madison school shooting on December 17th, child care, all these other issues that they have prioritized. However, there was Republicans that pointed out on the floor debate that, well, if you wanted to address these things, you could have also introduced a bill. Meanwhile, Republicans like Senator Van Wangard, a co-author of this amendment, defended the measure and put it very bluntly that this is basically an idea to make it harder for Democrats or the courts, specifically the state Supreme Court, to eventually, if they would, to act to repeal the law. So let's first hear from Democrats and Republicans on this very issue before we get into more details about it.
Senate Joint Resolution 2 being on the floor today is tone deaf. It's a disgrace. You should be ashamed. We owe those families apologies, and we owe the people of this state an apology. And they need to understand that this is the majority that they elected to represent them in this state legislature, and this is what you do.
This amendment is here today because I am unwilling to let this basic election integrity measure be overturned by the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
I know there are a lot of issues going on in the state of Wisconsin. This issue is a very important issue. It was ready to go, and it was my bill, and I introduced the bill. I would ask my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, how many bills have you introduced for this legislature today? How many? Zero. This is the only bill that's been introduced. That's why we're here talking about it.
So just to be clear, this would be on the April ballot once it clears the Assembly next week, which is expected to pass. And this would mark then the sixth time constitutional amendments have been before voters in just the past year or so. And this has really just been the new avenue for Republicans in divided government to get their agenda across. Meanwhile, I talked to other Republicans like Senate President Mary Felskowski, who also said, well, hey, you know, this process is working because voters do still have the opportunity to shoot down the referendum or to approve from, which has happened over the past year.
Look, officially, this is all about putting voter ID in the state constitution. Unofficially, it's about putting it on the April ballot, maybe draw more conservative voters out for the Supreme Court race. Now, look, I've seen this tactic before. We both have over the years. I'm not sure the ballot by itself will goose enthusiasm among conservatives, unless there's money spent behind the amendment. Recall the amendment from the August election that was put on the ballot. Republicans were very confident about that. Democrats organized, I think, spent $3.5 million against it and shot it down. Voters shot it down. So I'm kind of curious with this amendment, will it really drive turnout? Because if you think about the stakes, April 1st, Supreme Court race, state superintendent race, if I were a donor, I'd probably put a check more toward that than an amendment question. So we'll see. But yeah, there's a little bit of a side effect for Republicans in doing this right now.
Right, and this also came on the same week that Governor Evers basically introduced again a similar measure that not just lawmakers would have the avenue to introduce constitutional amendments, instead they could be put forth on the ballot by voters, and that's what's called a citizen-led referendum process. Now, the governor proposed this back in 2022 as a way to create a pathway for voters to repeal the state's criminal abortion ban. That was immediately shut down through a special session. However, this time he's proposing it in his state budget, which would force joint finance to vote on the issue sometime this spring. So he introduced this that would basically allow voters to alter or create new laws. And Evers believes this is, you know, quote, a fair way to give voters a say on many issues that are popular in statewide polling, you know, gun reform, repealing abortion laws, among other things. So let's take a listen from the governor, we do not have a video for this topic, I apologize. But looking at this too, JR, Evers has proposed this before. It's unlikely to go anywhere, but it was, again, we had these dueling narratives on this issue through this entire week.
Well, you know, Republicans are trying to say that this is the avenue through them. You're usurping their constitutional responsibility. To critics, that means they don't think the voters are smart enough or responsible enough to do this on their own. But look, Republicans control the keys to this entire car. So why would they turn it over? Why would they give up their power? I've not seen in my career any politician, any level of government, where they said, you know what, I'm going to cede authority to somebody else and let them have this. So there's that thing, too. With the amendment process we have now, voters do get to vote on everything. So what I'm kind of curious about is, you know, you mentioned the governor, this is require joint finance to vote on this. Jesse Rodriguez, Republican from Milwaukee suburbs. Shannon Zimmerman, Republican from St. Croix County. They're on finance committee. They were targeted in 2024 by Democrats trying to flip the assembly. They both won. Is this going to put them in a tough position? I don't get the impression it will. Much like voter ID, it's a popular issue. I think 74% of voters surveyed in the last Marquette poll in 2021 favored voter ID. But I don't get the impression that drives voters. If lawmaker X voted for or against voter ID, I don't think that's like the driving issue for them, the polls. What might be interesting, though, with voter ID is, does it impact Susan Crawford? Because she was an attorney, part of the team that challenged voter ID. Back in the day, it was passed in 2011, I believe. She called it draconian in a op-ed in 2018, running for the district or circuit court. So, does that maybe have more resonance with her because she'd be a judge? Maybe. I'm just not sure these things politically have a huge impact on voters when it comes down to it.
All right. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, when asked reporters about Evers' budget proposal, he called it DOA, dead on arrival. It's not going to go anywhere. But again, this just goes to show the governor is still trying to get his message across ahead of his State of the State address and, of course, his budget address that will be happening later over the next 2 months or so before both of those speeches. But looking even at historically using this power, Democrats have also used constitutional amendments. Let's just go back to that as well. You know, I talked to political science professors. They say, yes, this seems like the new pathway for Republicans to get their agenda across. But don't forget, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Democrats also used the same pathway. So as long as you're elected to the legislature and you control both chambers, it's kind of your playbook that you can use.
For Republicans, it's a reality of they can't get through Evers' veto pen. There's a way to go around the governor.
Exactly. All right. As mentioned, it was also Inauguration Day on Monday, so we're just going to highlight that a little bit, and this will kick off the Wisconsin Legislature's 107th legislative session. So over a quarter of lawmakers took the oath of office for the first time. As we know, there's 6 new state senators, 31 assembly members following the November elections, which were under the new legislative maps that gave Democrats a little bit of an edge. Now, looking at the Senate, there were speeches from Senate President Mary Falzkowski and Senate Minority Leader Dianne Hesabein, kind of setting the tone for this next legislative session. Let's first take a listen to them.
In this time of sensationalized politics and 30-second Twitter clips, true debate on the Senate floor is needed more than ever. From this chair, I will ensure the right of the minority to be heard as they argue their case, while at the same time ensuring that the will of the majority still reigns true. I will expect and encourage robust debate, but require the dignity and respect for the rules that our constituents expect of us. To have a government of the people, by the people, we must respect this body.
My goal this year, and my challenge to every single one of you, is to work with one another, our constituents, and experts in the field to achieve common sense solutions. Let's show Wisconsinites that they're legislators, that you and I, and that this Senate body is a force for good.
Now, those were kind of the same tones that we've heard from Democrats and Republicans about what they would like this next legislative session to look like. We've also constantly heard from Democrats that they hope these tighter majorities in both chambers can lead to more compromise. I think that's something that remains to be seen, but I think basically of how the mood is, or the mood that's already been set this week, is that Republicans are going to prioritize tax cuts, addressing some education issues, and then, I don't know, it could be maybe a pretty short session, Chair.
Talking to people this week, they aren't confident a lot's going to get done this session. Also worth noting, I'm not expecting the Senate, from what I've been hearing so far, to be back until February, so there's not going to be a whole lot to get done first month. I mean, go back 2 years ago, much busier first month of the session. This time, not so much, partly because, one, the reality is set in. They've got narrow majorities. What can they get done? In the Senate, they went from 22 to 11 for Republicans, 18 to 15. Last session, with 22 votes, they struggled on big things constantly. So at 18, what can they get done? Two, do you want to keep throwing the same bills at Governor Evers that you've done before? From my hearing, we'll see some bills on transgender athletes, right? We'll see that for sure. We'll see a tax cut bill. Robin Voss has promised one before the budget. Still not quite sure if it's going to be retirement income like he wants or a crossbar like Devin Lemmy he wants. We'll see. You'll see red meat issues, but immigration stuff, we'll see that. Really more interested in how do the new lawmakers vote. The number of Democrats who are in swing seats. On the old maps, there really was only Steve Doyle who could even possibly lose. They were so compacted into like deep blue seats, there weren't many competitive seats. Now, the top 11, half of them are in the assembly, half of them are Democrats. So will they be more bipartisan on some things, or maybe vote more moderate? Tammy Baldwin, for example,
yeah.
You saw that bill in the U.S. Senate. She voted to advance it. Now she has problems with the version of the bill right now. She wants
the
to be addressed.
The
immigration bill. Okay. So will we see things like that? In the Senate, will Devin Lemieux get Democrats to help him push bills through? That's the thing I'm really watching, because there's a thing called the Rule of 17. It is almost become a mythological thing in the Senate where you only pass bills, you have 17 Republican votes, right? They've broken that a lot when it suits their needs. This session, how often will they break it, and on what might they break it for?
Another issue I'm watching for is also that Monday processing bill. Of course, we know it passed the Assembly last session, didn't get there in the Senate, but, you know, after, once again, another contentious election where results, especially Milwaukee, not to pinpoint them, but, you know, they do central count. They had to recount 31,000 ballots. It took them till a little after 4 a.m. to get the results in. No one really likes, us nor the public or lawmakers, like watching those results trickle in that late. Is that going to get done? You got a new chair in the assembly of the elections committee. So we'll see kind of where it goes from there. But that's something I'm keeping my eye on. Another issue that I did ask Assembly Speaker Robin Voss about that he would kind of signaled could be AB1, which is the first bill the assembly proposes, would address DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, lowering their standards for statewide testing. That's the Wisconsin Forward Exam and ACT. So this kind of come to head after Governor Evers criticized the move. He actually called it a mistake when he had a press conference with reporters on Monday. And it comes after Speaker Voss, like I said, has signaled that he really wants to address this kind of right off the bat. Now, what that bill would look like, who knows? But it does, in a sense, speak volumes that even now Governor Evers, who was the former state superintendent of schools, who actually approved the previous standards, is now saying, hey, there should have been more involvement. There should have been more discussion with stakeholders, the public, other people involved in education, kind of talking about this before Dr. Jill Underley made these changes. So let's hear from Evers and Voss on this issue.
There should have been some information and dialogue happening with all sorts of people before that decision were made. I'm not even sure how many school people knew about it. And so I think in retrospect, if I would be have criticism, it was about the process. The mistake was that there wasn't enough conversation with the stakeholders, with parents ahead of time.
When I saw that Superintendent Underly wants to make it harder for parents to understand when their school is succeeding or failing, she wants to make it easier for failing schools to somehow seem like they're succeeding, I think that's one of those areas where we even saw Governor Evers say he opposes that. I would hope that no one, the most liberal person or the most conservative person, would want to dumb down our standards so kids aren't able to read and the parents aren't able to even know whether or not their kids are succeeding.
You heard Voss say dumbing down the standards. So if you're an opponent of this move, that's kind of the lane that you believe in, because it is almost impossible. It is impossible to compare this year's scores to last year's because of the changes and cutting the test scores. But for since June, these changes were enacted. Underly has defended them, saying this is, you know, going to be better measurements in the future. And this all just comes down to changing specific words of how you describe how proficient your student is performing in your classroom.
And Underly pushed back on X this week, saying this is not dumbing down the standards or lowering them. It's putting them more in line with reality in Wisconsin. I think I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but this is going to factor in the DPI race. So the filing deadline this week, no surprises. Underly is going to run again. Jeff Wright, a superintendent, is going to run. So is Brittany Kinzer, education consultant. This is going to be an issue for Underly in the DPI race. The question is, does it resonate? Had that Supreme Court campaign kind of like overarching everything in Wisconsin this spring. So if you're running in DPI or turning attention, how do you break through that noise? What money will be there? And this is going to really, will this hurt Underly come April 1st?
All right, let's move on to our next topic, which is going to be talking about the state Supreme Court race, or education funding, excuse me. I apologize, I'm going out of order today. Continuing on education, we want to bring up also another newsworthy note that Governor Evers made related to his 400-year veto that we've talked about on the show before, and about his push to, of course, add more funding in his state budget for K-12 education. So on Monday, what he said is that he called it a joke that Speaker Voss thinks schools can get by on the current spending boost over the next 2 years. He's now vowing to propose an even bigger increase in his state budget. And this comes after Voss suggested last month that if the court upholds Evers' veto, increasing per pupil aid 400 plus years, schools are mostly off the table. And GOP lawmakers will focus their attention on other things when crafting the 2025-2027 state budget. So this is really an issue that we've talked about before, and it's going to come to head once budget crafting season comes.
So a reminder, people at home, these caps were imposed in the 90s. They basically limit how much schools can spend each year between state aid and property taxes. The more state aid in the formula, the less you raise your property taxes. Right now, the 23-25 budget had a $325 per kid per year increase. So $325 the first year, add $325 more. The next year, Governor Evers uses veto to keep that annual increase going for four centuries. Now, the two caveats are, one, lawmakers and Evers could agree to change at any time, so it's not locked in for definitely for 400 years. And two, the Supreme Court has been asked to overturn that move. So will the court say that went too far? So what Robin's saying is, if the court upholds it, the discussion basically would be how much state aid goes into that formula, period. And Evers is saying more. Well, what's more? What's going to be enough in the governor's mind? Didn't really answer that. He just kind of gave us some hints of his budget on what's going to come. We talked to him last Friday. So I'm curious, what is enough for the governor? And not just the per pupil increase, but mental health costs. He said he won't address those. What all is he planning for education? We do know he said $4 billion, which is what Underly wants, is a big number. So, okay, we know that's not going to happen likely. Mm-hmm. Well, what is his number going to be with that surplus of $4 billion this biennium, and then revenue growth of expected to be $1.7 billion additional over the next 2 years.
Right, and I'm also curious, what's the timing of that lawsuit, 400 veto, that's before the state Supreme Court? Where does that fall into? Is it going to happen a little right before budget negotiations, after? I mean, we never know when these decisions are going to come out. I would expect hopefully before that, but that remains a factor as well.
I was going to say, the budget may not get done on time this year. So the court may have time.
We say this every 2 years, but they're because of the smaller majorities, especially in the Senate, right?
There's also a little pressure. Think about it. Somebody pointed out to me this week. School aides, if the court upholds the veto, that's locked in. They get an increase. Shared revenue, local aid, state aid to local governments, they're getting automatic increases now through this formula tied to the sales tax. So there's no pressure from local governments or schools to get stuff done. I heard the theory this week, and it's just a theory, from a Republican that, you know, maybe they don't do a budget. Maybe they kind of let things slide. We'll see. Now, they'll push a tax cut, or maybe they break things up incrementally and do, like, little bills. I mean, it's early. I hear this talk every 2 years about how difficult it's going to be, and they always find a way to get it done. But, you know, I would take the over when the budget's going to get done this year. Let's put it that way.
All right. Something to keep our eye on. All right. Now we're going to move on to the state Supreme Court race because, as we mentioned earlier in the show, the race has officially solidified now that signatures and nomination papers have been turned in to the Wisconsin Elections Commission. But we want to look at the money because what you're seeing on this screen is a lot of it for this early. But this actually shows us now that this means both the candidates are on track to surpass the most expensive Supreme Court race in U.S. history when it was 2 years ago. So this is Crawford, a Dane County judge. This is how much she has raised since May of 2024. Looking at Schimmel's number, $2.2 million. That's since he entered the race, which was pretty early, back in November of 2023. So a lot of money that they're working with. But I think the storyline here, too, JR, is that this could once again break records here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, a couple of things. So one, yes, they're well ahead of the $1.6 million roughly that the four candidates had raised at this point 2 years ago. But the candidates aren't going to drive this train. It's going to be outside groups. So yes, people I talked to expect this to exceed the $56 million I counted in 2023. But when push comes to shove, will conservatives match the liberal money machine that we've seen in Wisconsin the last few years? We'll get a hint of that possibly these reports are actually filed. So this is what the campaigns told us. We have not seen the reports of detail. How much does Susan Crawford get from the state Democratic Party, for example? Mm-hmm. The party endorsed her late last year. Remember, parties can make unlimited transfers to candidates. They can receive unlimited contributions from donors. That's a huge factor in these races. Daniel Kelly, 2 years ago, said, I'm not taking transfers. Brad Schimmel has said, I'm going to take transfers. The Republican Party has not been able to match what Democrats can do in the last 2 years, but that will help drive expenses. So, yeah, there's lots of moving pieces, but at this point, we're ahead of the game. Oh, by the way, Americans for Prosperity, a conservative group, reported on Thursday spending $1 million on digital ad campaign already. Now, that runs through April 1st, but that's just part of their $1.3 million in spending already. Tells you what's coming. You know, I would not be surprised to see more reports come in next week of independent expenditures, which are those vote for, vote against, support, oppose kind of things, because there's no primary. The race has begun. So with no primary, you can start going to the right now. So your airways may be filled with ads, not really filled like the presidential race, but you're going to see more ads earlier in this race. You might usually see them.
Right, because it was 2 years ago, there was four liberal candidates running.
Two conservatives, two liberals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it was much more advertising, a lot more people trying to get their message out. There's a lot more forums, I believe, one that we did 2 years ago as well. So likely not going to see that much activity, but, you know, if they want to get their name out, now's the time to actually start seeing those ads. So just when we got that little bit of breathing room after the holidays, after the November election, they're likely going to gear up again. All right, let's get to stock picks this week. And rising this week, the three individuals that you see on your screen, we are focusing on appeal court judges, all three of them, who are unopposed for re-election.
Again, they were unopposed 6 years ago, too. Now, there's a reflection of two things here. One, the four districts we have for the appeals courts in Wisconsin are pretty partisan-leaning one way or another. The second district, where Mark Gundrum is, former Republican lawmaker, Waukesha County Circuit Court judge, the second, based in Waukesha County, pretty conservative. There's one liberal in that court, Lisa Neubauer, ran for Supreme Court back in 2019. She survived in 2020, her re-election bid for appeals court, in part because there's a primary for president that drove Democratic turnout that helped a lot. You have the 4th District, where Jennifer Nashhold is. There are no conservatives. A Dane County-based court, dominated by Dane County, pretty liberal. I mean, so you see in these districts, there's not really a competitive environment, so there's that. Two, it's hard to beat appeals court judges. They don't lose very often. How do you get people excited about that race? How do you get attention? So that's another challenge here. But really what I'm bringing to is it's part of looking forward to 2026, 27, 28. So I know it's a long way away. But remember, the Supreme Court race in April, if conservatives don't win this seat in April, they can't flip the court until at least 2028. So remember, Rebecca Bradley, conservatives, up in 26, or seat is, so she hasn't said what she's going to do. 2027, Annette Ziegler's seat was up, another conservative. then 2028, Rebecca Dowell, liberal. So if you're a conservative, you don't win in April, you've got to get through, hold two seats in back-to-back years, and then have your shot in 2028. Well, liberals, Jennifer Nashold, as some people talk about as a possible Supreme Court candidate, because, you know, if you're on the appeals court, you kind of have a path to maybe run for Supreme Court. Chris Taylor, also in the 4th District, passed on a bid this year. Pedro Colon, 1st District Court of Appeals judge, passed on a bid this year. So maybe when they need a candidate in 26 and 27, look to those names. Or other, like, circuit court judges. For conservatives, the bench is a lot kind of narrow right now for a couple reasons. One, Maria Lazar passed on running for Supreme Court this year. She's on the 2nd District Court of Appeals. She might be a candidate. Also, Shelley Grogan, same appeals court, possible another candidate. But Governor Eaton has been appointing judges at the circuit court level for 6 years now. Mm-hmm. He fills lots of positions. There are fewer conservatives getting those appointments because it's a Democratic governor.
Right.
Fewer judges to get their feet. Now, there have been people who beat Evers appointees in some of these spots in conservative seats. But my point is, the liberals have a bit more of a robust bench right now for the future. Conservatives have a narrow one. Doesn't mean they can't win, but they've got a narrower bench right now. And you put Gundrum on that list. He's thought about running for Supreme Court before, or had an eye toward it. We'll see.
All right. And let's get to Mix this week. It was Representative Lindy Brill, who broke with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss in voting for him for Speaker.
Yeah, which is no surprise, actually, if you follow their campaign. So if you go back to the race this summer, Terry Katzma was a lawmaker from Gooseburg, a member of the Finance Committee, part of the leadership team. He retired. Lindy got in the race to run for that seat, pretty conservative seat. Republicans in Madison looked for somebody else to run because they thought she might be a little bit not part of the pro-Voss team. And during the campaign, there was a mailer run against her by a group that was viewed to be aligned with Voss that roughly said she didn't support allowing soldiers overseas to vote. It's kind of a interesting kind of allegation. But anyway, she came in not real happy about the leadership. She said in a statement after her vote, which she abstained from voting for Voss or for Neubauer for Speaker, I pray Voss proves me wrong. But no mistake, surprise, I ran as an anti-leadership person in the campaign. So she came in with this kind of head of steam of like, okay, I'm not happy. Chuck Wickers, we talked about him before. He and Robin have had an interesting relationship over the years. They both abstained. It underscores, one, the need for Voss to get more than 50 votes this fall, which he pulled off. And two, the question of, will these guys be perpetual thorns in the side, or can they be won over and be part of the team? Don't forget, there were four Republicans who abstained 2 years ago,
right,
leadership vote. One's
gone. But
they
had a bigger majority then.
Yes. Yeah. Janelle Branchen was one of them. She's now not in the legislature, but she's actually an aide to Chuck Wickers, which is going to be fascinating to watch. But my point is, again, the team is narrower. Can Voss keep the team together? And will Lindy be somebody who is going to be a thorn in the side going forward?
All right, wrapping up the show this week with falling. Its recycling numbers are down due to a Wisconsin Policy Forum report this week.
Yeah, so per capita, down compared to a decade ago. Lots of factors going into this. How we live, unfortunately, we buy fewer newspapers, for example. There are fewer to recycle, but we shop more through Amazon, so more cardboard coming in. Less aluminum. Younger people, I hear, drink less beer.
They do. You know,
so there are fewer cans. Just things like that are happening. So the thing to keep in mind, though, is even as this tonnage has dropped, the costs have gone up a little bit, I think 0.6% for municipalities. Same time, the aid from the state to help fund recycling has been stagnant. They cut it in the 11-13 budget. It's been about $19 or $20 million each year since then. So those grants have gone from being like 30-some percent of the overall cost down to like less than 16. So it's still a strain for local governments to collect this stuff and process it with less help from the state.
All right. That will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.